upon throwing a leg out of the boulder squad.
He might be out of play for a little while.
Yes, hello and welcome to Football, the midweek edition of the Fox Football Cast podcast. I'm Murray Shaw, and today we will rip and tear into the announcement of the Socceroos squad for the upcoming Asian Cup, plus look back on a bizarre week in the Hyundai A-League and Westfield W League, and look ahead to this weekend's Christmas round. So joining me, as always, is Brenton Speed and Andy Harper. I'll start with you, Speedy. How are you?
Good, Muzz. We are doing it right as the Socceroos squad drops for those out in podcast land. So it's almost like you're experiencing this breaking news as it happens.
Andy Harper's up on the ranch. How are you, Harps?
Present and very well, thank you, Murray. Very well.
Right, so the full squad for the Asian Cup for the Socceroos is Mustafa Amini, Aziz Bajic, Martin Boyle, Milos Deganek, Alex Gersbach, Ryan Grant, Chris Economides, Jackson Irvine, Matthew Yerman, Robbie Cruz, Mitchell Langerak, Matthew Leckie, Mas Luongo, Awa Mabil, Jamie McLaren, Mark Milligan as the captain, Aaron Moy, Andrew Naboot, Josh Risden, Tom Rogic, Matthew Ryan, Trent Sainsbury and Daniel Vukovic. I don't think any great surprises in that squad, Harps, but I guess the big omission is no Tommy Urich up front.
And of course, the speculation around Chris Economides, that's great news for him.
We'll get to that in a second.
No huge surprises. Tommy's obviously, was it Tommy or Jamie McLaren falling foul? Tommy's the one who's missed out.
What do you make of the omission of Tommy Urich, Speedy?
Well, I think we forecast it when we spoke about our prospective Asian Cup squads about a month ago or so, that Tommy Urich isn't doing enough when he plays, isn't doing enough at club level, and that's a move that had to be made, even though he was a hero 4 years ago providing the assist for James Troisi in the final. I think there are better options right now. The Aaron Moy selection is interesting given what Huddersfield Town did on that front, and there's a little note that the FFA have provided on that front saying that Phil Coles will be inspecting Aaron Moy's knee on the 21st of December, and there'll be a finalisation by Christmas Eve on whether he is indeed part of this squad. And is Aidan Hrustic the man on standby for him, or
they haven't announced that? I would imagine it's probably more likely to be Jimmy Jego would come in replace. To replace Aaron Moy. We'll get to the Moy news shortly. The Tommy Urich omission, Harps, just quickly.
Yeah.
Is it time for Tommy to look at whether it's coming back to the A-League or certainly getting a new club so he can get a bit more football?
Well, that seems to be a central consideration. I mean, he was going well in Europe, and he seemed to have hit the skids. And you know, this is a... In this world, it's always a change of coach, or your fortunes can just swing completely on the breeze. And if Tommy was to try and see out some more time in Europe, those fortunes could change in his favour. There's plenty of history to suggest that that could happen. So, it wouldn't hurt him. Put it this way, I think we all agree it wouldn't hurt him to come back to the A-League, because we know the robustness of the local competition has got a pretty good track record in relaunching players' careers. Tommy's already done that once, coming back from Europe as a younger guy, starting in Adelaide, then to the Wanderers, and then off he went. No reason to suggest that couldn't work for the second time.
Speedy, Chris Economides has been rewarded for his good form to start the A-League season. Are you happy to see his inclusion?
Yeah, definitely. I think we forecast that as well a month ago or so. He was off to a red-hot start with the Perth Glory. I think he adds a different dynamic to the attacking options, and I can see him starting one of the games at the Asian Cup on that left side and looking dynamic in a front three, because Arnie's going to go with a front three each and every time.
Aaron Moy, Harps, we touched on that before. Good on the FFA for not letting Huddersfield dictate whether or not Moy is going to be fit for the Asian Cup. You can see Huddersfield's plan was hoping that Australia wouldn't name him, and then if they don't name him and he makes a miraculous recovery, he's available for them in the first week of January. Even talk in the paper today that he probably will head across to the UAE and work on his recuperation over there, and might be available to play for Australia at some stage in the latter stages of the tournament. What's your take on it all?
So that would mean, of course, if he's not 100% fit or close to, then they'd be really having a squad of 22 and hanging on, hoping that they get deep enough into the tournament and Aaron recovers sufficiently. I guess that's the presupposition of the last point you made. But to the opening salvo, Muzz, that you fired, I think I agree. Good on FFA. I mean, there is no way on God's earth that they could afford not to scrutinise the readiness of their best player to defend their Asian title. Anything less than that would have been grossly negligent, I think. And so they have to do whatever they can to get, you know, their own levels of satisfaction that Aaron's can or can't contribute to the cause. And I think I'd be very surprised if there's anyone in Australia who didn't support what FFA are doing.
And with Moy not being available, say, for the first two games, which I think is the sort of feel we're getting, even if he is eventually, finally, part of this 23, you're looking at two holding midfielders out of three when you look at the squad in the midfielders category, Amini, Irvine and Luongo, two of those three playing each and every game. Or are you looking at Milligan no longer being part of the defenders crew and going into the number six role for Australia, and then you have Degenek and Sainsbury in the heart of defence? I think that's why Milligan's versatility is so handy. Even this morning with Hibs, he came on and played at the base of the diamond.
Any questions about his fitness, though? I know he missed a couple of games with Hibs, and then he and Boyle and McLaren couldn't get back into the team because they'd been winning. But are there any lingering doubts on Mark Milligan's fitness?
Well, he came back this morning and played the second half. He actually should have given away a penalty as well. He was clearly handling the ball inside the box, but got away with it. So, he's back playing for Hibs in the Scottish Premier League, so that's a good sign fitness-wise.
What about the Amini inclusion and the discussion even this far? And he did well the last time he played, but where that pits him against that Terry Antonis spot?
You think that's exactly like for like, Amini in the Antonis role? I think you could afford to sacrifice one of the attackers if you want to bring a Terry Antonis in. Andrew Naboot hasn't played a whole lot of football. He eventually got back into the Urawa set up late in the campaign. You got Economides, top heavy with attackers, like 2, 4, 6, 7 listed in the attacking category that I've got here. And normally it'd be 5/6 or even 4/5, wouldn't it, in the attacking area. So I think that's where Antonis has been missed out. I mean, Jamie McLaren, does he deserve a spot after those stats we've mentioned before? And could Antonis take a McLaren spot? Because I think Matthew Leckie's the man who leads the line when he's available each and every time now.
Oh, I think you're right on that last point. But, firstly, is Terry Antonis a lesser player than Mustapha Amini in general? The answer to that would be no, particularly in this form. Secondly, Mustapha Amini left Australia. I'm not saying that that's what he's doing now, but he left Australia as an attacking midfielder. And maybe isn't considered in that sort of discussion now, but that's how I always imagine Mustapha, which is probably more of a reflection of his career developing more than my view of him, and that's fine. But what I will say is any notion that Terry Antonis can't play as a 6 or an 8 at a pinch, when given his history as a professional, a senior professional, I think is wrong. I mean, just to slate him now as an attacking midfielder, largely on the basis, really, of his outstanding form for Victory this year, is I think, selling him a little bit short, to be honest.
If we look at the major omissions, or the notable omissions, no Craig Goodwin, no Dimi Petratos, no Adam Taggart, no Terry Antonis that we've touched on, no Tommy Deng, and obviously no Tommy Urich. Speedy, start with you. Anyone there unlucky?
I think Antonis, in the form he's in, playing alongside some great talent, of course, the best team in the A-League right now, I think in just about everyone's opinion, even though Perth Glory are clear at the top. So are those talented players taking Terry's form to another level? Could he then produce that alongside Socceroos players on this stage? I think he's the one who stands out. Craig Goodwin is the honourable mention behind them. I think Dimi Petratos has dropped off big time, didn't deserve a spot right now. Adam Taggart's body is doing him no favours. Tommy Deng could add something to the attacking mix, but Ryan Grant sort of gone past him in that right-back role, in the opinion of Arnie. But I think Antonis is the standout omission in the form he's in right now. And There are some other suggestions on why he was left out of the squad. Have you got any theories on it?
Tommy Deng or Terry Antonis?
Antonis.
No. I mean, all you can say is he's been playing particularly well for Melbourne Victory, and, you know, it did look a like-for-like, I suppose, a little bit if Aaron Moy was to be ruled out that Terry Antonis would come in. Do you think there's anyone unlucky out of that lot, Harbs?
Antonis.
Yeah.
Resoundingly so. I think you could... I agree with Speedy's little rock-hopping around the descriptions around the other players, certainly. But, I mean, my previous comments, I would have had Antonis in before Mustapha Amini, say. Which, again, is not to heap coals on Mustapha because he's a fine player, but I just think Terry Antonis' game has gone to another level, purely on the levels of his fitness, to be honest with you. I must confess that I had my doubts, and they're going to remain untested because he hasn't been picked, but I had my doubts about Terry's mobility at international level. And he's hit them over the mid-wicket boundary this year. He's in the best nick of his career. Speedy's reported that through the commentary. He acknowledges it himself. That's been the key defining factor for him this year. His football's always been great. His ability to get round the park has been what's troubled me. And he's dealt with that largely this year. And I think it's his omission is screaming loudest to me.
Righto, Speedy, give us your starting 11 for the first batch.
Well, I've gone Matt Ryan in goal, picks himself, and then I've gone Bayich, Deganek, Sainsbury and Risden across the back four. Given that Aaron Moy is unavailable, I think, almost certainly for game one, I've gone Milligan to anchor midfield, and then I've gone Amini and Luongo in the eight roles, if you like. And then up top, I've got Leckie as the number nine, Boyle on one side, and I've gone Andrew Naboot on a wing ahead of Robbie Cruz, for instance. I mentioned it before. Seven attackers. Boyle, Economides, Cruz, Leckie, Mabil, McLaren, Naboot. They're all going to play? They're all going to play at some stage in this tournament? Or have we gone with one too many there? And should there be another player as a midfielder?
Just on that, Harp. So the general consensus seems to be that Matthew Leckie will start up top and he's going to be turned into a striker by Graham Arnold. That's a lot of pressure on a guy who, I mean, he hasn't got an abundance of goals for the Socceroos over his career. Are you confident he can do a job there as a former striker yourself?
Well, I don't think anyone can be completely confident. You know, if there was one of the other guys we've talked about ad nauseam, banging goals away, then I don't think we'd have been looking. And Graham Arnold would have been looking to move Matthew Leckie into the central position. I am going to presume that he would have stayed as a rampaging winger. And this is a cut-and-paste job. I mean, does anyone disagree with that, that this is a cut-and-paste job? So I've got huge expectations that he's going to win the golden boot. But if he is deemed the best option, what Matthew Leckie will do is create enough havoc up there and hopefully get some goals for himself, but create opportunities by the havoc he causes for other people to bag a couple.
I think the penny has dropped with Matthew Leckie. You watch what he's done since he's gone back from the last Socceroos camp. He's rocked back at Hertha Berlin, and he's actually scored two great strikers' goals. The ball floated in the air for one, and he sort of read it in flight, got there and just poked it home with real poacher's instinct. And his goal just yesterday was a fabulous goal on his left foot with real poise underneath the goalkeeper. So I think he's taking it to heart that he really needs to be a regular goal scorer, and it appears to be the fact that I think he can score quite a few goals at this Asian Cup.
The other...
I was going to say, that let's hope that proves to be correct, Speedy. But scoring goals from an auxiliary position in the Bundesliga is great, and he can score some good goals. It's a different mindset from leading the line as a striker, as an out-and-out striker. The atmosphere changes in your head, in the part of the field you play in. And I certainly hope he can make that transition, and he will be a good enough player to at least cause havoc. And I hope on the back of that, he brings a bit of goal-scoring touch with him, which he is refining. But is he a natural leader of the line and penalty area centre-forward remains to be seen. I hope it's answered in the positive.
I think Arnie's formation that we got to see in his last couple of internationals. It's really that front three are three strikers, and they rotate around a bit. So Boyle will come through the middle. If it is Naboot, then he'll rotate through the middle as well. And I don't think there'll be that pressure saying that Leckie's our number nine. And I think they'll say we've got three number nines.
I can't believe we also didn't mention in notable players who didn't get picked, your man Ben Falami from the Ipswich under-14s or whatever he is. How come he didn't get called up, Speedy? Surely you're calling for Arnie's head that he hasn't mentioned Falami. It's somewhere in there.
No, I will say I would take Falami ahead of McLaren.
There you go.
McLaren's not playing for Ibs right now. Falami's a better talent who will get more shots away than Jamie McLaren will.
I knew I could rely on you for a big call. Let's move on to the other big news in world football over the last 24 hours, and that has been the axing of Jose Mourinho at Manchester United. And Brenton Speed, once again, was well ahead of the curve here, Harps, who called on this podcast, well, on the Monday edition of this podcast, in 2014, Speedy said Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will be Manchester United boss within the next how many years?
I said 3 years.
So you got that wrong.
Yeah, I got it wrong.
Yeah, you got that wrong. So he's coming in at the end of 2018. Is he the man for the job, Speedy?
Well, I think he'll do a pretty good job. I think he'll add some vibrancy to the way Manchester United play. I think he'll pick the right team. I think we'll see more minutes for Paul Pogba after that fallout that he had with Jose Mourinho. And I was impressed with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer when he was in charge of Cardiff City and what he did with Molde in Norway as well. And come the end of the season, if they the results improve and suddenly they're knocking on the door of a Champions League spot and maybe even snatching one, then maybe the chorus will be, well, why not just keep him in charge for next season?
Harps, can you remember ever a coach going from the highs of Jose Mourinho to where he is now? I wouldn't go so far as to say he's now a laughing stock, but geez, his credibility's gone to the extent that you sort of wonder whether another club's going to pick him up and whether he's got a future as a club coach. He led the way in world football for so long. We used to look up to Jose Mourinho for what he did in his early days at Chelsea. Speedy, you were over there in the UK. And now when he leaves, it's like, geez, you can't believe how far he's fallen. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a bit extreme. It's been a highly public fallout. The divorce has been ugly and a long time in the making, and so there's a lot of emotion that goes with that. He built a formidable reputation on the back of winning the Champions League with Porto. It's probably the last club of that stature really to do a Leicester City in the Champions League for him. Let's face it. And that got him into the Premier League, and away he went, and he reset all sorts of records. And the fall has been very dramatic and very public and very ugly, actually. Hasn't it been ugly? And there'll be a lot of people, actually, I'm thinking, who are suggesting there's a bit of karma with this because of, the way Mourinho has been reported to have conducted affairs behind the scenes, not with this necessarily, this group of players, but just, the activations with his agent and very ugly that when Van Gaal left Manchester United and Mourinho went in. I was in the UK around about that time, and geez, it was acidic. Some of the coverage and the commentary, and you just get the feeling that there's a lot of karma in the eyes of some people coming back on Jose. And then on the related to that, of course, a lot of this pretty awful commentary. So he's not finished as a coach. This game,
he's bought a lot of that on himself, Harps. He's bought a lot of that on himself.
Well, apropos my comments, people are saying there's a lot of karma in this. I'm not defending it. But whether he's finished and it's a massive blow to his credibility, well, it's a hit. I think he'll recover. He's never coached the Portuguese national team, and it's something that he's flirted with publicly. That might be an option in the future as well. But, club football is so topsy-turvy, and a lot of club owners and boards, they're on a hair trigger, and a few bad results, someone will get trapdoored, and then Jose will be parachuted in. I don't think we've seen the last of him.
Do you think so, Speedy? Do you think a club, a Premier League club, let's call it a top 10 Premier League club, would go Mourinho currently, given what they've just watched at Manchester United?
I think so. I think a big club will and take a gamble on Jose Mourinho. But what you would be doing is you'd line him up for 2 years and then whatever happens, just say thanks for your time, thanks for that 2 years, and don't go into the third-year syndrome, which tends to be the pattern for Jose Mourinho. It all falls apart in season three of whichever club is in charge. When both times at Chelsea, I think that was the time frame involved. So that's what you got to do with Jose. 2 years, turn things around, get him out.
He looks like a guy that needs a break. They always talk about Guardiola. Wherever he goes, he has a bit of a sabbatical before he goes there. So if it was at Bayern Munich, he took a bit of time off, learnt German prior to going to Man City. He took a bit of time off just to recharge the batteries. I mean, we can only imagine the pressure that's under on these coaches when they take
up
these
you,
roles.
What about you, Muzz? You think he's done and dusted? You don't think anyone's going to will take a chance on him?
Not in the short term, no. I just think all the baggage that comes with him, the criticism of the players, the prickly relationship with the media. If you're a top 10 club in the Premier League, yes, you might get some short-term success, but, you know, they look at this Manchester United now and think, well, is that really worth it? Again, if he takes a year off and comes back a new man and he seems a bit recharged, then it's probably a different story. But right about now, no, I can't see him going back into instant club management, probably at any of the big four in Europe. I could see him, as you said, going international football and maybe getting a job like that where the pressures aren't as great year-round or week-to-week, but obviously they are when... and teams are competing in tournaments.
Well, one of the things in that commentary, in the changeover from Van Gaal to Mourinho, one of the things that I read repeatedly, and he's fallen on this sword, was how destabilising he was reported to have been, or at least in the opinion of some observers, in the background of these clubs, right? And that same destabilisation has been around him at Man United, and it's you're probably suggesting this, Muzz, and I'm repeating it, but it's like a case of, if you're going to dish it out, you've got to take it. And he's moved into the spaces, in and around the spaces in club football and between clubs on the back of all this speculation and destabilisation and speculation, and the same thing's happened to him at Manchester United. And don't expect that leopard to change its spots anytime soon.
Quickly, Speedy, where are they going, Man United, in the long term for a replacement? Plenty of talk about Mauricio Pochettino. There's a lot of talk about Zinedine Zidane, Laurent Blanc, Antonio Conte. Where would you go?
If you can land Zidane, it's a no-brainer. You bring Zidane to town and a fellow Frenchman, get the best out of Pogba if he's going to hang around. But don't rule out Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doing something special. I know he's contracted to go back to the Norwegian side, Molde, and it's all just a short-term stopgap with Mike Phelan going from the Mariners to help out Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well. But, if it all clicks, they might just stick with the status quo.
Do you think Phelan will take any Mariners players with him to Manchester United?
I think he might hold fire on that one.
Bolt on the top of the shop.
Yeah, you saying Bolt, he'd be a start. New signing, Khalifa Cissé, just to sturdy up the defence.
Well, this is Bolt's great chance and his Machiavellian plot coming to fruition actually getting into the dressing room at Manchester United as a player. Yeah. He plotted a long course for this, Usain Bolt.
Yep. You could say he was two steps ahead of everyone, Harps.
Well, at least one long stride, yes.
Righto, let's move on to the A-League. And quickly, your players that you enjoyed watching from the last round of A-League, W-League, Andy Harper, yours is an Adelaide defender.
It is. Michael Jakobsen, who's made a really good transition. Great partner for Jordan Elsie, who unfortunately had a bad game on the weekend. Critically so, actually, for the team's sake. But really impressed with Jakobsen's transition. I thought his game on the weekend was excellent. His passing out of defence was so positive. In fact, I haven't gone back over the tape, but my recollection was, apart from a couple of stabilising passes, every time he had the ball in settled possession, his passes out into the midfield were the bulk of the time, very positive, aggressive, and accurate, and really set Adelaide going forward. Of course, the problem with Adelaide is they can't finish at the other end, but that's not Jakobsen's fault, and I want to give the Dane a big kick. I thought he's been very good and was outstanding on the weekend.
Speedy, yours is from the W League?
Yes, Savannah McCaskill in that crazy game at Cromer Park.
We'll get to the crazy times at Cromer Park.
Yeah, but she was unbelievable. Her speed off the mark to be able to run away from players. Her first 10 metres is phenomenal. And also her thinking, her skill level. There was one pass she went outside of the boot, over the top of the defender, almost parted the defender's hair, and then found her winger in a wide area. We saw her juggling during the stoppages as well. She's got an amazing touch. And she came up with her first W League goal as well, pouncing upon an effort to head it home from 1 metre out. But it showed a hunger to score goals and do well for Sydney FC. She's a fabulous player.
You were going to mention my player that I enjoyed watching last weekend, Speedy, but I've stolen him from you, and that's Eugene Galekovic, who is just a solid contributor week in, week out for whatever club he plays for, and has been over the length and breadth of his very expansive and extensive A-League career. He's not only a solid contributor, he's a consistent contributor. He will win you games as a goalkeeper. And there's nothing better. And we mentioned Carl Valeri a little bit a few weeks ago. These players that you sort of think are finished, and the coach probably thinks they're finished, and they start looking at replacements and backups, etc., and they put their hand up early in the season and say, I'm not finished yet. You can still get a job out of me. And Carl Valeri was one we mentioned before, and Eugene Galekovic again on the weekend, just showing his class and quality. And you watch Eugene Galekovic and think to yourself, there's a player that if he had have landed a move to Europe somewhere along the line of his career, probably would have had a very successful career in Europe because he is so consistent, a bit like, I guess, Danny Vukovic is now doing over in Belgium.
Yeah, and Harp spoke about the way that Jakobsen's passing from defence was very good. Eugene Galekovic, his passing has improved big time. The ability to find his fullbacks and get them on the right foot. How often do people, even outfielders, pass to the wrong foot of their teammate? So then they have to go backwards and get into defensive mode. How often did Galekovic find an out ball to Scott Jamieson, hit him on his left foot so Jamieson can go forward? And likewise, the right back, he paid credit to Zeljko Kalats, the new goalkeeping coach at Melbourne City, and he's bringing out the best in him.
Looks fit too. So no doubt a big year ahead. Just quickly, Hubs, while we're talking about goalkeepers, on A-League Hour, you were pretty strong on your views of the brain explosion from Vedran Janjetovic in the Sydney Derby last weekend. We know he's going to get a one-week suspension from the FFA for the red card. Should the Wanderers also be should he basically be sitting on the pine for a couple of weeks because of what he did, or send off sufficient?
Well, there's two ways to answer that, Muzz. So the send-off is sufficient, obviously. If you're running the club there, you think, right, well, I can't afford to have that. I need to be comfortable that this guy's mindset is ready to service the first team and the supporters. And what could well save Vedran, if that question is being asked, what could well save him in the short term is a lack of depth. And does Marcus Babel feel like he has an adequate alternative? Is there enough competition for places at the Wanderers for the goalkeeping position? Because if there is enough competition, then Vedran would have to be spending some time on the sideline. It was just the most ridiculous thing. And the more I see it, the worse it looks. It doesn't get any better in replay.
Are we confident they win that game if he doesn't get sent off?
They'll go mighty close, yeah.
Yeah, well, it was the best start to a derby they've had for a while. And then Sydney had no answers. So they were flying. Mate, they were flying. And it was just, it makes it even worse, actually. But trying to keep the incident in isolation, it's got to be time to cool your heels on the bench if they have the depth. And that gets into a whole broader discussion. Mars, I don't know if we've got time today, but, how do we have a policy in the league, and it's all around the salary cap, where clubs can build greater depth? So this sort of technical, tactical sin can be punished adequately internally by the club.
Yep, it's a fair point. How do you take it, Speedy? Should the Wanderers hang him out to dry a bit because of what he did on the field, or...?
Oh, you just hope that he doesn't make that brain explosion again and he'll learn from it. Surely he won't do that sort of thing again. And I think Harps was sort of mentioning the fact that is the depth there, and is the replacement who came on, Nizic, good enough to keep Janjetovic out after his one-game ban? I wouldn't have thought so. Also, the refereeing during that sequence was wonderful. Jared Gillett saw that Jan Jedovic had flown through the air, tipped it off his fingertips and actually forced that shot wide of the goal, and also saw on the angle that when he did handle it, it was outside the box. Straight red card, no hesitation. That's why he's the best ref in the game, although he did miss a pen on Milos Ninkovic. And why the VAR couldn't weigh in there, I don't know.
Don't open that can of worms with him. But let's just go to that discussion about Jan Jedovic, but not about veteran, about the broader issue. Because I think a league with a salary cap is almost by definition too forgiving on these sorts of things. If you don't have the depth, you can't actually put someone in the icebox for a while to do their penance and someone else has the chance to grab their spot. That speaks fundamentally to a problem in your league's mechanism. And I think the salary cap is very sharply coming into focus at this stage of the league's development. And I'm just going to jump off on a tangent and tell you why. Everyone talks about, you know, the costs and blah, blah, blah. We've got Alain, a co-confederate member of the AFC, about to qualify, has qualified for the FIFA Club World Cup. Right, to win that, they're going to pick up, which is highly unlikely, but just imagine they did, $5 million. To get to that point and succeed through Asia, etc., they would have picked up in the vicinity of another $3 million, give or take, $ with bonuses, etc. So for Alain, and even if they finish runner-up, what's that, $3.5 million next week? That they would have pocketed, for themselves or their league, however it's distributed, $6 million. Right, and what are we getting in that in this revenue challenged game? The club's hamstrung by the salary cap and not able to assemble the best possible teams and challenge for this stuff. There's this whole pot of revenue potentially for the A League, which we just cannot reasonably expect to access. Last year's Champions League, for example, the J League attracted through its winning bonuses and progression through the Champions League. $ 4.2 million for the J League and for the Japanese football. What did Australia get for 2018 Asian Cup?
How much did we get?
About 500,000.
Yeah.
Asian Champions League. But that's paltry. That's a paltry amount when you consider what, with changing the policies, maybe our teams could actually start to chase. There's a lot of money growing in Asia. For example, the Champions League in 2015. The prize money was something like $4 million. In 2018, it's $10 million. This is all US.
Mm.
And it's going to grow. And how can our clubs reasonably access that revenue that is sitting there waiting to be won with a salary cap that's like concrete around their ankles? This fundamentally has to be seriously addressed by the new board and however this new business model for the A-League looks, because everyone's talking about businessmen want to have to aspire, and they want to be motivated to build and win. There are pots of money in international club football which we've got no hope of getting our hands on unless we restructure ourselves.
Speedy, you were quick to take to Twitter after the send-off, questioning why Marcus Babbel decided to take Baum Johann off. Looking back on it, do you stand by that, or can you see why he might have made that decision?
No, I can't see why you make that decision. You've got Soterio, Kamau and Riera up front. Baum Johann is the best player in your team. He can release anyone. So keep one of the pacey ones, take one of them off, go more lopsided up top. By definition, you've gone down a man. Don't take off your best man and take Riera off, leave Baum Johann and play those two speedsters as a front two where Baum Johann can play them in. Riera didn't do much. Baum Johann, as I say, has the best passing game in the opening 20 minutes. He put 5 through balls through that could have led to goals.
Mm.
You keep him out there and you work it out. You improvise with the other front three.
It's a very defensive tactic. Rather than saying we can still win this with 10, it's with 70 minutes to go or whatever it was, 64 minutes to go. Harp's basically saying, I need someone to do a job for me for 64 minutes. All we're going to do is defend for the next 64 minutes rather than thinking to yourself, well, if we keep him on there, we might actually jag a second goal. And you never know, we might be able to hold on and win this thing.
Well, I think it was a double concession. I agree with Speedy's assessment, so I won't add to that. But in these situations, sometimes as a coach, or maybe more than sometimes as a coach, you've got to think, what does my opponent not want me to do, and therefore I'm going to do it? And the sense of relief for Sydney, who are under the pump, at going a man at, going to an extra man because of the send-off wasn't alleviated in any sense. Indeed, it was only added to by withdrawing Bomiyah, because it's a double win for Sydney. Steve Corica, the coach of Sydney FC, is thinking, right, OK, pressure's off to a certain extent. They've got the extra man, and who are they going to take off? Wow, I've just won the lottery.
Mm.
And whether people agree or not with the mechanics of taking Bomiyah off and understanding the thinking behind it, and, you know, you've got to cut a coach a little bit of slack and understand at least the process he went through, what did your opposing bench want you to do or not want you to do? And have you just played into their half desire, which is, as it turned out, was the case? Oriel Riera, again, in hindsight, didn't do much. You're not to know that at the time. Of course, he struggled in that Lone Ranger role. And indeed, when Western Sydney Wanderers ended up losing the match, it was because of set pieces, and Riera was there for the Sim Dyong finish. So actually, there was no material benefit to leaving the physical presence of Oriel Riera as part of the equation at that point. All that's with the benefit of hindsight. But what I think in this, the interesting discussion in this tactically is, having the mind of your opposing coach, and is your decision actually going to give him comfort or cause him distress? And I think by the players looking at Bomiyah going off, the Sydney FC players, they grew another foot taller. And I think on those terms, it was a boo-boo.
Speedy, some big games this weekend, some really big games with a lot hinging on them. One of them, incredibly enough, is probably across the Tasman with the resurgent Wellington Phoenix hosting the struggling Brisbane Roar. Is a loss for the Brisbane Roar over at Westpac Stadium, is that now crisis time for the Brisbane Roar?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, definitely. John Aloisi's under the pump, and sadly for him, when you look back, when he lost his job at the Melbourne Heart, that was right around Christmas time. So hopefully for him, history isn't repeating right now, but how long can Brisbane keep the faith with John Aloisi if the results do not come?
Harps?
Yeah, the pressure's building, there's no doubt, but there is no need to fire a coach unless there's a considered opinion that he's come to the end of his cycle with this club or this group of players, or he's done something, you know, criminally bad. Because otherwise what you're doing is, without the threat of relegation, what you're doing is actually second-guessing your own decision initially. I don't think John Aloisi has become a bad coach. They're in a bad patch, and he's got some severe question marks. But by dropping the sword across the back of his neck, firstly, you're then putting your own decision-making into question because you thought this guy was going to be good enough. And secondly, in getting rid of someone who I believe is a good coach, what's your frame of reference for actually replacing him accurately? So, of course, they're under pressure. They're all professionals and they don't want to be in this position, and I'm going to back them to work their way out of it. And how they deal with the pressure is going to be interesting. But the ultimate sanction at this point, I would like to think he's not in that discussion because I think he's a good coach. But one thing I did, the feedback I would offer the club and John last week is, how well do you know your players? And when Eric Boatiak felt so aggrieved by that accidental foul when he got his leg tapped 7 minutes before the send-off, He was very obviously at that point beyond the point of no return. He had lost his temper completely. It took 7 minutes for him to actually execute the damnation of that foul, and then the histrionics that went after it. But John Aloisi knows his player. He's refused to leave the field after that treatment, which is just what players are supposed to do. I just reckon at that point, if Johnny just holds him for another minute, just sit down and get some treatment, and someone have a quiet word in his ear or me and just quiet him down, and know that if you don't quiet him down, there's an ultimate sanction awaiting, and guess what happened? And I think if they could change anything, it would have been that.
Other big games this weekend, or interesting games with a lot riding on them. There's a Melbourne derby, Speedy, where we get to watch Melbourne Victory, who we're all enjoying watching at the moment. Melbourne City had a good win last week, which relieved the pressure a little bit on Warren Joyce and made us forget about Bruno Fornaroli for another week. But you'd only imagine a loss to the Melbourne Victory in the Melbourne derby, and up goes the pressure valve again.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to this game, the pre-Christmas Derby on December 22. It'll be the second last game before Christmas, and I think they will have their work cut out. Might need some more heroics from Eugene Galekovic, because the Melbourne Victory are just doing as they please right now with their one-touch football. Who's going to stop that? Bart Schenkerfeld got our man of the match the other day, and so they're looking pretty impressive defensively, Melbourne City, but they'll have to be at the top of their game here. Can't wait for this one. Warren Joyce, I'm not sure this result will do anything to the pressure. I mean, he won the first derby of the season, so you lose this one after a win away to Adelaide. I'm not sure it's going to be a biggie on that front.
And Harps, Newcastle versus the Central Coast Mariners on Sunday at Central Coast Stadium also looms as a huge game for the Mariners, who are, you know, if we're being blatantly honest, staring down the title of being the worst A-League team we've ever seen.
Yes, not travelling well. Can I just go into bat for Bruno Fornaroli and say, irrespective of Melbourne City's results, I don't think the league or that club is a better proposition without Bruno Fornaroli. So there we go. I'll just leave that one to hang because it's appalling that it hasn't been resolved or can't be resolved. But to Newcastle and the appalling Mariners, I mean, it's appalling. This state of affairs is appalling. The coaches change, but we end up in the same place. The fundamental questions need to be asked if they haven't already. I mean, who is responsible for this year after year? I would like to think the decline isn't terminal. In fact, I'd like to think it's fallen as far as it can, but we've said that before. And the false dawn around the Mariners has enlivened us until we've just been let down. And I feel, I don't know how much I'm speaking on behalf of other people, but I feel completely let down at the moment as a fan of this thing and what they've done in the community over the time. So is it up to Newcastle United and the return of Roy O'Donovan to just plunge the dagger completely? I suspect so. They need to win as well, the Jets. O'Donovan is just going to be champing at the bit.
I hope he's not champing at the bit too much.
Yeah, well, given the history, yeah, I just think I can't see a way forward at the moment for the Mariners unless Mike Mulvey goes strong on his promise to blood some energising young players. Chabot looked good when he came off the bench, got their first shot on goal after 80-odd minutes in the last start. It's an appalling situation. I don't know how else it can be described. It's up to them to change.
And sadly for Andrew Hall, he's looking at an unwanted A-League record. If they lose and he plays a part this weekend, it'll be the 13th consecutive loss for Andrew Hall, which would equal an A-League record with Guess Who, podcast listeners. I don't think you're going to come up with this one. It's from season one. He was a New Zealand Knight. It's Joshua Maguire, who suffered 13 straight defeats between round one and round 21 in the 13 games that he did play. But Andrew Hall's another one who's been getting limited game time. And when you look at the squad, I'd have Hall and, as you mentioned, Chabot getting some more minutes.
And
what about the injury toll? Where does the Mariners' injury toll rank currently with the rest of the comp?
I don't have stats on the injury toll, Harps.
Off the top of your head, then. Off the top of your head.
They've been hurt badly by injury. But you'd also have to say, and I'm not looking to plunge the dagger, as you would say, into the Mariners, because I'd love to see them bounce back, because a tight competition is a good competition. But they've probably got one of the best squads they've had for a number of years. Would you not agree?
With Tom Hiarie featuring,
who's
in
clearly
that squad,
had a fallout with someone because he can't get a run.
Who gets to the bottom of that? That's because they're outside the big markets. No one's got to the bottom of Hiarie and Mulvey. What doing?
They reckon he's got a calf injury. The point about the injuries were, from my cursory reading of things, these are in the preventable category, right? So does this get to the resourcing levels around the club? Is Mike Mulvey fighting with one hand tied behind his back? I don't know. These questions certainly need to be answered. But in Tom Hiarie, if he is ready to play but has just been black banned, well, it's ridiculous. But I tell you, if I was another club on the lookout for a passing midfielder to start my attacking play, he'd be one of the top ones on the list.
And Kai Rolls, poor old Kai Rolls, has now gone 16 games for the Mariners without a win. He's probably forgotten how you sing the song. What is their song? Probably Horses by Darryl Braithwaite, isn't it?
Paul Oakon might have taken that CD with him.
He might, it doesn't exist in the dressing room anymore. W
League. Isn't it anchors away?
W League, tonight, we're recording this on a Thursday, so Thursday night, football is in Brisbane at Dolphin Stadium with the Brisbane Roar taking on the Western Sydney Wanderers. A week ago, you touched on it before, Speedy, you were at Cromer Park on the northern beaches of Sydney to watch a crazy game between Sydney FC and Adelaide United. When the lights went out, the rain came down, but you ploughed on through it.
And the lightning as well. It was amazing. I think it was 3 hours from kickoff until full time after a delay of more than an hour when the lightning came, then the lights flicked off, and somehow Sydney FC, in amongst all that, came up with 5 goals in the end. And Princess Abini is growing in stature before our eyes, still a teenager, comes up with 2 goals off the bench, 2 pretty tidy finishes as well. But I can't wait for Sydney FC in action this weekend in the W League. It's not the Thursday night game, but it is part of a Friday night doubleheader. That is a cracker.
Yes, taking on Sam Kerr's Perth Glory. And it was great scenes out at Cromer Park, Harps. There was probably about 2,500 people there before the rain hit. And it makes me think that these Thursday night W League games are a great game to take out to the people, play at these smaller suburban grounds so that we can pack them out and people can come along and look at the heroes.
I think it's a great point you make. And, I, you know, it shouldn't just stop at the W League, but on occasion taking the A League, so long as it's well planned, I think they must. I think if you give people enough warning in that local community to realise that the big show's coming to town, let's go and have a look at it, you're going to get a great reward. And, the W League compared to the A League is probably a more mobile competition at the moment to serve those ends. And I think the point you make is an outstanding one. That response from the Peninsula people was really positive. There's no reason to suggest you wouldn't get the same down in the Shire if Sydney played down at Shark Park, or you took them out into a venue out at the mountains to play at Penrith. And you just—I don't know what to say apart from I'm in violent agreement with you, Murray.
Yes. So Thursday night football tonight is at Dolphin Stadium. I think the following week it's McKellar Park in Canberra. The following week it's at Dorrien Gardens in Perth. So smaller venues, pack them out. Great atmosphere and hopefully see some great football. So that brings us to looking at this weekend where, as I mentioned, tonight's W League, Brisbane versus the Wanderers. Speedy mentioned the double header in the W League, A League at NIB Stadium in Perth with Perth Glory taking on Sydney FC, which is a huge game in both those competitions, the W League and the A League, because I think Sydney have won something like their last 8 against Perth Glory in the A League. Also in the W League on Friday night, it's Adelaide versus the Melbourne Victory, which should be a good game. Saturday, the A League is Wellington versus Brisbane, which we've touched on, and then the Melbourne Derby. And in the W League, Melbourne City, as a curtain raiser, in fact, to the Melbourne Derby, are playing Canberra. And then on Sunday, it's the F3 Derby with the Central Coast Mariners hosting the Newcastle Jets. Then we've got a couple of days off and the round finishes on Boxing Day in Adelaide with Adelaide United taking on the Wanderers. So some really, really good football there for people to enjoy, hopefully with a bit of time off to relax during the school holidays leading into Christmas and then after it. And then we get really busy after Christmas when we start ripping into midweek rounds in the A-League. And of course, you guys are off to the United Arab Emirates for our coverage of the Asian Cup and the defence of our Asian Cup title. I guess all that's left for us to say now, Harps and Speedy, is a happy Christmas to everyone who's listening to the Bald Podcast. And I will ask you, Harps, what's in your bald sack for Christmas?
Well, my bald sack for Christmas, that poses a whole visual, Murray, that I'm hoping for, you know, candy cane and Christmas puddings. And I just hope that everyone else's sack is filled as they'd like it to be.
I think that's a great message for everyone. What about you, Speedy?
I want that, hopefully, the Socceroos mount a brilliant Asian Cup title defence because we'll be there, and hopefully the country that we'll be supporting, although neutral when we're on air, of course, goes on a great run.
All I can say now is happy Christmas to everyone. Happy Christmas to you, Andy Harper.
And you too, Mars and Speedy and everyone. Thank you very much for 2018 and looking forward to a prosperous 2019. Happy, with expansion in beauty.
Happy Christmas, Speedy, and safe travels to both of you for the Asian Cup.
Yes, Merry Christmas all. So we're not doing another one of these before the Cup.
I don't see how we can possibly fit it in, but you guys will be busy over there. Daniel Garb will have the tape recorder, and I imagine you'll be podcasting your way through the Asian Cup. To everyone, have a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you when we see you in 2019.